Translation: earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. Altogether, these eight constitute my separated material energies. Purport: the science of God analyzes the constitutional position of God and his diverse energies. Material nature is called Prakriti, or the energy of the Lord, in his different Purusha incarnations, as described in the Satpada Tantras. For material creation, Lord Krishna's plenary expansion assumes three Vishnus. The first one, Mahavishnu, creates the total material energy known as the Mahatattva. The second, Garbhodakshayi Vishnu, enters into all the universes to create diversities in each of them. The third, Chirodakshayi Vishnu, is diffused as the all-pervading super soul in all the universes and is known as Paramatma. He is present even within the atoms. Anyone who knows these three Vishnus can be liberated from material entanglement. This material world is a temporary manifestation of one of the energies of the Lord. All the activities of the material world are directed by these three Vishnu expansions of Lord Krishna. These Purushas are called incarnations. Generally, one who does not know the science of God assumes that this material world is for the enjoyment of the living entities, and the living entities are the Purushas, the causes, controllers, and enjoyers of the material energy. According to Bhagavad Gita, this atheistic conclusion is false. In the verse under discussion, it is stated that Krishna is the original cause of the material manifestation. Srimad Bhagavatam also confirms this. The ingredients of the material manifestation are separated energies of the Lord. Even the Brahma Jyoti, which is the ultimate goal of the impersonalist, is a spiritual energy manifested in the spiritual sky. There are no spiritual diversities in the Brahma Jyoti as there are in the Vaikuntha Lokas, and the impersonalist accepts this Brahma Jyoti as the ultimate eternal goal. The Paramatma manifestation is also a temporary, all-pervasive aspect of Chirodakshayi Vishnu. The Paramatma manifestation is not eternal in the spiritual world. Therefore, the factual absolute truth is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. He is a complete energetic person, and he possesses different separated and internal energies. In the material energy, the principal manifestations are eight, as explained above. Out of these, the first five manifestations, namely earth, water, fire, air, and sky, are called the five gigantic creations or growth creations, within which the five sense objects are included. They are the manifestations of physical sound, touch, form, taste, and smell. Material science comprises these 10 items and nothing more. But the other three items, namely mind, intelligence, and false ego, are neglected by the materialists. Philosophers who deal with mental activities are also not perfect in knowledge because they do not know the ultimate source, Krishna. The false ego, I am, and it is mine, which constitute the basic principle of material existence, includes 10 sense organs for material activities. Intelligence refers to the total material creation called the Mahatattva. Therefore, from the eight separated energies of the Lord are manifested 24 elements of the material world, which are the subject matter of Sankhya atheistic philosophy. They are originally offshoots from Krishna's energies and are separated from him. But atheistic Sankhya philosophers with a poor fund of knowledge do not know Krishna as the cause of all causes. The subject matter for discussion in the Sankhya philosophy is only the manifestation of the external energy of Krishna, as is described in Bhagavad Gita. So in this verse, Krishna describes one of his energies, that is Prakriti, the inferior Prakriti. And later on he mentions the Jiva, and then he describes himself as the controller of both. So here we have a list of material elements which expands into 24. Here we have the gross elements, and then mind, intelligence, and false ego. And, of course, we expand these into sense objects and senses, and 10 other senses, plus the sense objects, five sense objects right there. And In this way we get a total of 24 elements, material elements of this creation. Modern science, of course, has a little different conception of elements, and they have 100 and something. Oh, how much is it now? It used to be 108. Maybe it's 115 or something now. There's a few very unstable elements that they created kind of artificially. Anyway, they analyze according to molecular structure elements. So they got many more elements than are here. But if we look at those elements, basically they're all earth, water, and fire, and air elements. They all come within these categories. They don't have ether, mind, intelligence, false ego as elements in the Western atomic charts. They're not there at all. So the Vedic conception of matter is a little different from what the modern materialists are saying, the modern scientists. If we examine the analysis, this way of looking at the world from the Vedic point of view, we see that the whole material creation is actually constructed in such a way that it is for the enjoyment of the jiva. In other words, we have all the material elements which combine in different ways. Plus, we have inbuilt in material nature the facility for perceiving these things and getting some enjoyment. Therefore, we have sense objects as part of material creation. If we have matter but we don't have any way of enjoying them, then what is the use of material creation? So there's an inbuilt facility for seeing these things, perceiving with the different senses, that is, touch, taste, etc. And that's part of material nature. The sensations that we get is part of matter in order that the jivas can enjoy. And we need a sense organ to enjoy it with. And these are also part of material nature. Normally, from modern science, we'll think that a sense organ is only made out of matter. You've got an eye and you can analyze the elements into different carbon forms or something like that, you know, organic elements. From Vedic point of view, the sense actually is another element. It's not a composed of matter. So when we speak of the senses in here, the ten senses, we don't mean these senses, obviously. And that is confirmed by the fact that scripturally, by the fact that there's a description in the Bhagavatam, story of Paranjana. There, that's an allegorical story of a king in a city. And at a certain point, the king gets driven out of a city. There's a war going on, and he gets defeated. And he has to leave the city, and the city burns down. So the city, or the pura, is the material body. And it gets burned down means he dies. He has to leave the body because the body gets subject to death. So then it describes he leaves the city along with his ten servants, the senses, and the pranas as well, the snake with the five heads. And these are the pranas. So he goes out of the city along with his senses. Well, we know that when the body dies, your senses are, your material senses are sitting in, and they rot along with the rest of the body. So therefore, these senses go with him. And again, we know that after you die, if you're unfortunate, that is, you end up in a hellish planet someplace, and there you have full sense perceptions, and you have a body also, and you experience pain. You experience many things. You can see and you can feel and everything. But it's not obviously your gross physical body, because that has already departed. That's already rotten. So therefore, the soul experiences in another body. And it cannot be the soul either experiencing, because the soul is not subject to birth, death, old age, and disease, or pain, or anything. Or it can't cut up. But this body certainly can. In hellish existence, they poke you with all sorts of swords and things, and they burn you up and everything, and you really feel it. So obviously it's not your spiritual body that are getting infected. So therefore this shows that we have senses, and we have another body with the hands and feet and everything, but it's not this body. So therefore we have what is called a subtle body. We have a gross body with its so-called senses, but we have another body that also has senses. And those are the senses that are spoken of when we speak of the senses here, not these gross senses. Vedanta Sutra also speaks like this and says that the senses are atomic because they go with you when you die. So they cannot be like these senses. There's something else subtle, more subtle. So therefore, these senses, the ten senses, actually the active senses plus the knowledge-gathering senses that are spoken of here, are actually subtle senses belonging to the subtle body. And beyond the gross body, we have mind, intelligence, false ego. These are components of the subtle body also. So therefore we get a completely different list of elements in the Vedic literature, as well as gross elements. We got subtle elements, and the subtle elements don't even look like elements. They look like consciousness or something like that, because they're all to do with the mind and perceptions. But nevertheless, the Vedas classify these simply as material elements, and they do not belong to this. They're not part of the soul. It's not spiritual at all. Now, in Western culture, generally when we talk about subtle bodies and things like that, when we think, oh, that's spirit. We call it spiritualism in the West, where you deal with ghosts and other phenomena. But Vedas say, no, this is not spirit at all. This is matter again. This is a subtle body. It's another type of body, but it's also matter. So the Vedas have a very interesting conception here of matter, the gross matter, which is for the enjoyment of the living entity, and we have a gross body to contact it. Plus, we have a subtle body made out of matter also, which is basically a mental type of body. And through this we get perceptions, etc. And we hold, of course, emotions, memories, thinking power, identification, false identification. All these things are held in the subtle body. And it's all matter. Of course, modern science will say, oh, this is, what is this? How do we prove this? It cannot be proven. Whereas we can, to some degree, analyze the gross matter. So, yes, that is so. It's not provable by the same means. So, of course, modern science is taken the easy path and identified the gross elements and categorized them very nicely for us, and then they work with these elements and try to do things. The subtle elements also can be handled and worked with also, but they're more powerful and they're also more dangerous. And the two, because it's also matter, it also is related to the gross elements, and there's a connection between them. They're not disconnected. They are related to each other. And if we control the subtle ones, we can control the gross ones. So that is why the knowledge of the subtle elements has been rather secret. In the Vedas, they don't want to teach this because it is also dangerous to teach this, because if it gets in the wrong hands, then we can utilize this in very, very destructive ways. If we can start using mind element, and control that in different ways, then we can do lots of things with the material world. We see, of course, that the yogis, they have what are called siddhis, and in yoga, the basic sadhana is control the mind. Control the mind element. And when you do that, then you get these siddhis, these different powers, powers to travel about and observe things out of your body, to manifest material objects and things like this, to go to other planets even. So the yogi gets all these remarkable powers, which we find are, you know, pretty phenomenal. We say, oh, the spiritual. But actually, it's only a use of the mind element. And in general, even the yogis, they don't really encourage this type of indulgence to use these powers, because it detracts from spiritual development. It's just another material diversion. And moreover, they don't want ignorant people or motivated people to utilize these powers also, because it can be dangerous. And we see sometimes the demons do get hold of higher knowledge, and they will distort it for their own purposes, and then they are very, very destructive. Hiranyakasipu, for instance, he did great tapasya, and by the strength of that tapasya, he got such powers that he could disturb the whole universe. We see Dhruva, of course, could do this also when he did his tapasya. Then he got he could influence the whole universe with his powers. When we deal with mental energy, we can do a lot of things. In the modern world, this has gotten neglected to some degree, and we are concentrating on, you know, handling the gross elements, the gross material elements. But at the same time, there is a realization that there is something else mysterious also that is in this material world that's not gross at all, but which is very significant. And that's also being discovered by science, though it is not so prominent. It has also been discovered. At least it's not public in the sense it's public knowledge. It's not public knowledge, but it's nevertheless conceded that there are other forces in this material world. If something can exert force, proven force in the world, then it must be an energy of some sort. And if it's an energy, it must be real. So experiments have been done. They are subject to debate, perhaps, but nevertheless, no one disproved them either. So, reliable experiments have been done by different people in different universities, including Harvard and other places, and that they prove that what we can call mind is real. By a different experiment, such as the one experiment was to just make a machine that you cannot influence by physical means. You can't tip it, you can't do anything, you can't push it. All you can do is push a little button, and when you push the button, a ball falls down, and then it'll go left or right. And by chance, it should go 50-50 one way. So if you do 1,000 times, it'll go 500 one way, 500 another way, or maybe plus or minus one or two like that. That's chance theory. And it's calibrated in such a way that it's exactly even, so it should fall equally each way when you do more and more tries with pushing the button. So the whole experiment is to show if there's some other influence upon the way the ball falls. And that is only influences by your mind, because your physical action cannot do anything, cannot control. You can only push the button, and that cannot move the machine at all anyway. It only releases the ball. So the experiment was to see if the mind could influence the way the ball falls, to the left or the right. So they did many tries like this with many different people, and what they discovered was that you could influence it. And there was always significant deviation to one side. If you say make it go to the right and you press 2,000 times, there's a significant deviation of the ball going to the right. And if you say make it go to the left, then you press 3,000 times, it's a significant deviation. It's small. Maybe it's like if you have 1,000 tries, it's 515 one way and minus on the other side, like that. Or maybe 20 extra on one side, or maybe 30 even. But it's always a significant. It's not, you know, like normally just pressing it neutrally. It's always a significant deviation. So how do we explain that? What is making it go? It could only be the mental energy. And they tried it with different people, and they tried it so many times, and I could always get the same result. It would always move. Huh? And some people are better at it. They can make it move more. Some people can make it move more. Huh? So then they had to conclude there must be some other energy involved here, which is real, and it involves something to do with thought, because it's only your thinking saying make it go to the right or make it go to the left. So therefore they had to conclude that this other energy having to do, connected with the mind, exerts real force in the world and is therefore real. It's a real thing. We don't know what it is because it's not matter like, you know, earth, water, fire, all these, not made out of, you know, gross particles either. But yet, it exerts force. And therefore, it must be real. And what is also surprising is they discovered that you could have the machine in New York and you can have the person thinking about it in London, and you'll get the same effect. You get the same deviations of the person thinking in London and the person pressing it in New York. In other words, it does not decrease over space, the effect. And they also discovered it, you could do it in time also. So you could think about it 1 week ahead of time and carry out the experiment 1 week later. And you still get the same effect. So therefore, time and space were not significant for the mind. It could go over both distances, without distance and time, without decrease in effect. So the conclusion was that there is this energy called, we can call it mind energy or something. It's real, and time and space are no barrier for it. In other words, you can get the same effect over time and space. And this is not so with normal matter. Energy, normal material energy decreases over distance. Whether it's electricity or sound energy or anything, but the more distance it goes, the weaker it becomes. And it does not go through time, and you cannot do it through time like that also. So conclusion was that this is it's real, the mind is real, and it acts in such a different way than common energy, because time and space are not the same for it. So that was the conclusion that they reached. It's a real mind is real, and it is not subject to time and space. So this was an experiment, some of the experiments they did in that field, and that was the conclusion. So therefore, it's already there. The conclusion is already there in Bhagavad Gita. Mind is an element. Mind is real. It's a component of reality. However, we put it on still in the material world. Scientists don't know where to put this mind. What is it? Maybe they think it's spiritual or whatever. They don't really know what it is. It's something. But nevertheless, as far as being real, they know it exists. And it exerts influence on the gross matter also. So that's they got that far in those experiments with that. Another type of experiment also with the mind was more esoteric. And also it also shows the maybe the dangers also inherent in it, in the mind. And that is the idea that one can use the mind to observe objects at a distance. So some scientists prove, yeah, the mind is real and it exerts influence over distance. So then practically, how could you use that? So obviously it'd be nice if you could spy on people, like being here and then finding out what they're doing somewhere else far away. So that's exactly what they began to do. They carry out experiments for that to see if you could do this. So of course it's well known in the clairvoyant circle that people do this. You know, they can visualize something in another place and get information, or find out where a missing person is or something, or find out who the murderer was by just, you know, thinking or something like this. So it's there, but whether it's true or not, we don't know. So some scientists, very reputed scientists actually, did experiments. He was the head of the experiments, physicist. Hal Puthoff is the name. Stanford University in America. He was hired by the CIA to carry out investigations and to see if this, what we call clairvoyancy and all this, was real or not. So he did many experiments, and because they're scientists, they were very rigorous. They got a clairvoyant, a famous clairvoyant, called Ingo Swann. And they tested him in different ways using different experiments to see if actually he could, you know, predict things, you know, or see things like that. One of the simple experiments was they put some things in envelopes that he didn't know about and put the envelope in a box. And then he would have to say, okay, what's in the envelope? So somebody put a butterfly or something, or a moth in one of the envelopes and he stuck it in the box. Huh? So then when he came to that one, he said, well, this triangular-looking object, a flat triangular-looking object in the box, and it moves. That's his prediction for that one. And of course it was actually true, because it was like the wing of the moth was kind of fluttering around the side of the thing. And that was almost astonishing for them. Then they did experiments just with coordinates. They would put pictures into envelopes and then just write numbers, a series of numbers on the envelope. Then they would just give him the number series. And not tell him what was what it was at all. But he would be able to identify the picture inside the envelope just by getting a little few numbers. Like that. 0055594. Okay, what's that? And then he would identify a picture from that. So there's no way in which they could, you know, disprove it at this point. So then they concluded, yes, there's something there. He's got some sort of power. They even did another experiment where they put him in this. He had to identify some object which was buried under concrete about 10 feet under the earth. There was a sensitivity device to detect very small movements in the earth. And then they asked him, what is that object there under 10 feet of concrete? So then he drew the object. He drew a picture that was the shape of it and what it was like that. And actually when he drew it, then the object actually moved. The meter on it moved. It was affected by his mind, because his mind was thinking of the object and actually moved at that point. And didn't move before that point, but when he thought of it and drew it, then the needle and the thing began to move. So they were very shocked when they saw that. That his mind had actually done something to the object. And he identified the object also, which was under 10 feet of concrete. So that's when they took it very seriously. Now, of course, the whole object, their object was, they thought, they heard the Russians were using clairvoyance to spy on America. So then they had to get back and, you know, fight that with their own weapons. So they wanted to develop, you know, opposite direction and spy on Russia using these techniques. Then they asked them, okay, now in Russia there's, you know, installation in Siberia and so-and-so place. So you tell us what's there. So then he, you know, sat down and closed his eyes and relaxed. And then he drew a picture. He drew a map of the place and all this, and drew some machines which were there and everything. Later they spied with their satellites. You know, the satellites, they can take pictures. So they, with their satellites, they took some pictures of that place, that installation in Siberia. And it turned out to be the map was that he drew was about 85% accurate. And the machine that was there actually was there also. It's a strange looking crane with the wheels on the bottom on a railway track. They did another experiment which they couldn't prove, and therefore they dismissed it as not being true. And that was they found that he could go anywhere in the world and pick up information with 80-90% accuracy sometimes. So then they thought, well, why do we confine it to the Earth? Why don't we go somewhere else? So they said, why don't you go to Jupiter and tell us what's on Jupiter? So he did the same thing and relaxed. And then he started, you know, reciting, okay, now I'm in Jupiter. I'm at so many kilometers above the Earth's surface. The atmospheric concentration of chemicals of this, 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 and this. The color is this. The description is this. It looks like this. There's clouds like this. I'm coming down to so-and-so number of feet above the ground. I see a mountain over here like this. I give all little details like this. And they wrote everything down. And a certain point says there's a ring around Jupiter. And there's a mountain on Jupiter. Anyway, they recorded the information. And they thought, this is funny. I think he must have gone to the wrong planet. It must be Saturn he's gone to. And there's no mountain on Jupiter because it's all made of gas. So it can't be correct. So anyway, they more or less dismissed the experiment. Maybe it didn't work. But 10 years later, they did send up a probe to Jupiter. And then they did find there was a ring around Jupiter. And moreover, there was a mountain on Jupiter also. And the chemical compositions that he had described were actually pretty true. And the only things they could not prove was, as he was describing, that there were some pebble-like round things on the surface that are moving around. And that they could not confirm. But everything else was very, very accurate. And it was only confirmed 10 years later when the satellite went up there and got all the information. So anyway, that way they understood he could go far away from the Earth, which is how many millions of miles? I don't know how much. It's pretty far away anyway. And he could do it instantaneously to pick up the information. And it took the satellite 10 years to get there to get the same information. So that they discovered. And then the other thing is they discovered, well, if you can go so far, you could go anywhere in the universe, yeah? And moreover, if you can go in space, you should be able to go in time also. So then they began sending him backwards and forward in time and discovered he could do that also. So then we got real kind of strange. You know, the whole experiment went into like a metaphysical level where, you know, you could travel in time and space anywhere. That's one thing. And then the other thing is, then they wanted to know, can we train people up to do this? So then they did. They discovered that they could do that, and they developed a training program to train people up. Some people, of course, much better than others. But everybody, the conclusion was everybody has some innate ability to do this. Why? It's because everybody's got a subtle body, that's why. So to some degree, everybody can do it, but some people are more accurate than others. And they have certain protocols to follow for doing this. It's not like mysticism or anything like that. But they do involve techniques of relaxation. And some of the people that do this now that came out of that program and did the training, they have private programs now outside. They do it. And they also say that, you could, you know, you should do meditation. You should do TM meditation, relaxing this, and get your mind peaceful, all this, before you start doing these techniques. So obviously, it does involve the subtle body and things like that. So anyway, they developed techniques for doing this. And of course, they don't know how it works. Theoretically, at least, the scientist involved there, who's a nuclear physicist, he said his conclusion was, yes, these phenomena are real. The ability to go out of your body like this, observe things through time and space, it's an actual phenomenon. It's not superstition. That was his conclusion. He didn't say it like that, but he said it in very scientific terms. But nevertheless, he admitted it's true. It can be done. So therefore, we have to understand there are, powers there, and they are real. That's not this yogi's, it's not some myth or anything else that these yogis have powers like this. Common people can also get the powers. But then we see also that they can be grossly misused. In other words, you can use it to spy on people, materially speaking, and invade people's privacy and do so many things with this type of thing. As far as, you know, the government and military are concerned, that's as much as we know that the experiment went that far. But that was in that was over 20 years ago when that was being done. So we don't know what they're doing now. They're doing more things in that direction. Now, of course, we do know other things which are more, demonic or whatever in terms of experiments since they were doing other experiments, not so much with, you know, mind travel and all that, but basically with how to control the mind, physically speaking, using, you know, real gross means, that is, drugs and indoctrination, brainwashing, things like that. which, you know, was used during the war for, you know, counter brainwashing or whatever, or getting secrets out of people and things like this. So it's recorded that they did do experiments on people even, with this, with drugs and everything else to alter mental states and things like that on a very gross physical level. And they carry out experiments also putting little probes in the brain, electrodes, and stimulating different parts of the brain to, in other words, you have a pleasure center, a pain center, so many centers, and they discovered all these little centers, and you stick a little electrode in there, and then you can control the person's responses. So if you want a person to be happy, you just put the little electrode there, and he'll be happy all the time. Put it in another place, he'll be angry all the time, like that. In other words, the whole idea of some of these scientists was real demonic, and they said, this way we can control everybody in the world. We can control their responses completely this way. Then we can have a very peaceful society. Huh? We'll have no more criminals. Everyone will be very peaceful. We'll just switch them on to the, you know, the pleasure center, and then everyone will be very happy. And then they discovered that you didn't need to put the electrical thing in there. You could use it remotely. You could send a message. Yeah, from some machine, generate the waves, and, you know, locate that center in the brain, and then just do it from external source also. So in other words, you could influence people from far away using that. They also, of course, worked with implants, little devices you could stick in the brain, and then you could trigger people to do certain things at certain times, control them to do things, you know, by electrical response. A trigger in the brain puts off a little signal, then when it gets the signal, then you do a certain activity, like under hypnosis. There's a trigger. And then when you the hypnotist says a certain word, then you do a certain action, and you don't even know. You know, you just do it because you've been programmed to do that by hypnosis. So similarly, you can trigger a person with a sound or a tick or anything on the electrical implant, and then if you're programmed, then you'll do that activity, and you cannot control it. And they work with hypnosis and techniques like this on a very, very deep level, to program people in such a way that they could split their personality apart and develop another person within there who didn't know what the other person was doing. And they used this technique on actual people. And there was one famous example, and she discovered later, after, she didn't know what was happening, and later she discovered she was actually a model, a famous model in America. Somehow they got hold of her, and they did that. They programmed her like this, and she did all sorts of things, you know, for the, you know, secret police and all this in different countries. And later on, she didn't know what happened, and it was only much, much later that all these memories started coming back. And her husband, she married a person who had to be hypnosis, and he hypnotized her one day, and then she came up with all this information that she was doing all these things, and she didn't even know she was doing them, you know. So she was like a robot in a sense, and she was controlled completely. And then she, one part of her was normal, and the other part was doing all these activities, you know, spy activities and all these activities, and violent activities involved in espionage and killing and everything else. And she didn't even know she was doing it. And she couldn't remember it afterwards for many, many years. So in other words, she got, they were doing experiments like this to actually, you know, isolate parts of your personality and then use them for certain purposes. So in other words, it's like two people living in the same body almost, because part of your mind was doing something the other part didn't know about. But they developed techniques to mask it so that you couldn't tell. So they have been doing work in this area, and then that's of course by hypnosis, and then maybe they are doing other work in other areas, remotely controlling people by, you know, machines from distance also. And of course they did develop techniques of actually inducing different types of disease from a distance also. In other words, you can get a heart attack induced from a distance by a machine. So you can just flop over dead and they think you had a heart attack, when actually somebody's made you get a heart attack by pulsing certain waves into your body at a distance. So these are things which have been researched on and developed. So in there, of course, they've been utilizing the mind, experimenting with the mind in different ways. And, of course, it's all for manipulation. And if they combine this part with the other part of, you know, developing techniques of, you know, going out in the subtle body and doing things with that, you can do a lot of things, and you can do a lot of harm also with these techniques. So that is why in the Vedic system, they don't speak about it too much. Because if the wrong people get a hold of it, they can exploit everybody and take away everybody's free will. But that's exactly what people are doing in these experiments. They're taking away people's free will and playing with their bodies and making them do all sorts of activities they don't want to do. So how far the discoveries have gone, we don't know, actually, because this is not public. It's not public. So the only things public are, we know that experiments have been done on certain people, but how far they've advanced and what they can control now, and how far they've investigated this, we don't know. Nobody really knows. But nevertheless, from what has been publicized, we do know that the mind is an actual thing. It's a real element. And it does have powers of its own. And those powers can be used, but they can also be exploited. And if one person can exploit another person's mind, then we have a lot of problems, because our free will gets taken away at that point. So anyway, this is some of the aspects there. In the less scientific, of course, than this is the people who have clairvoyance and things like this. And of course, the CIA also used clairvoyance, and they said it's true. They can do things. So based on that, we can accept to some degree the testimony of people that can see other things. So they've also said that they can also, some of them can see the subtle body. So that's where we get the idea of auras and things like this. So some people do have a very accurate perception of these things. Some famous books have been written by different people on this. And one woman, she didn't know how she developed that vision, actually, but by constantly doing healing work and things like that, then she discovered that when she looked at people, she could actually see all these different bodies, energy bodies around like this, and the more she worked, the more clear these bodies became, and then she could actually detect disease by looking at the subtle body. And she could see how the diseases were there in the subtle body even before they were in the gross body, and the two were connected, the gross body and the subtle body. So whatever was on the subtle body worked its way gradually into the gross body. And in the subtle body, there were different layers, from the most subtle to the most gross, which are like shells, which are described in the Vedic literatures, and the Upanishads describe the koshas. Taittiriya Upanishad describes the Annamaya kosha, and the Pranamaya kosha, and the Manamaya kosha, Gyanamaya, Vijnanamaya, Anandamaya kosha. There are seven layers. So she could perceive layers, and she also perceived seven layers. And she said she could perceive a little bit of two more layers also there, which weren't so clear to her. She could perceive seven layers or dimensions of body, from the gross body all the way up to very, 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 very subtle bodies. And disease could manifest on any level and work its way back into the lowest level, and that is the gross body. And the most subtle level was like the level where you got karma. She called this the karmic level, And those ones were most difficult to remove also. And they would not manifest for a long time, and then suddenly they would start working their way and gradually get down to the gross body. So anyway, she had this this vision to see these sort of things. And her idea was that basically that all disease originated in the subtle body. Somewhere, either by your thoughts and your emotions, or from karma, which is in the subtle body, and that's how it worked its way into the gross body. And so it had a subtle origin, actually, in your thought patterns or your experiences or whatever, and it worked its way in. And of course, it can work its way back also. If you get a gross physical problem here, it can also go backwards and influence the subtle body. So it's not one way only; you can go back and forth. But anyway, she utilized her knowledge and her vision to work out cures for the subtle body. And by doing that, you could get cures in the girl's body. So that's her field of activity. But then she discovered, when she was doing this, that our funny thing was, she's working with the subtle body and the emotions and things like this, you know. The grossest body is there. Then we have a pranic level, and then we have a emotional level, emotional body, which is quite fluid, a lower emotional body, and then we get a higher emotional body, and we get an intellectual body. Yeah? So we get the mind and all its emotions and things like that. And then we get higher emotions like love. Then we get the intellect like that. And we get a few more layers, and we get ego up there on the top. And they were also related, the different layers of the body were also related to the different chakras. And the basic chakra, all the way up to, we have 7 chakras, and gradually they're related to the different chakras going upwards here also. And it's also related with different colors and so many other things. So anyway, she had this realization. So in this way, they're from different like fields. We see that this analysis is of material elements, which is not only in Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam, it's also in Sankhya philosophy. They also accept that this is kind of a common theme in different Vedic literatures, and Sankhya and Nyaya and everyone, they kind of accept this analysis of 5 gross elements: mind, intelligence, ego, sense objects, and 10 senses. They all accept that. But beyond that, then of course, more important is that we get the soul. And above the soul, we get a super soul. Now, these are not part of matter. But nevertheless, they all must connect together. What is the material world without the soul and without God? And God is the final controller, and the soul is the one that's trying to enjoy. So that, of course, is a higher type of thing that people cannot really perceive so well. So anyway, the material world is a little bit more complicated than we think it is. Now, it's complicated for the scientist because he doesn't even know all the principles for the gross material elements and how it fits together. And of course, we discover new things every day about particles and how they operate, etc. But then we get that sphere of knowledge, which is kind of invisible. That is the working of the mind, intelligence, ego, etc. That's even more, it's also matter, and it's influencing the gross matter also. So we cannot isolate the gross matter and just study that, because it's influenced by the subtle matter also. And the subtle matter is very difficult to study under normal scientific conditions. That's the problem. But nevertheless, it is very significant and very powerful also. So any real science has to include both. But then we also have to, if we're going to accept the mind, then we really have to throw out the whole idea of evolution and chance and all of that. Because what's the mind got to do with evolution? It's not evolving by chance, because it goes with your birth after birth. So it's something, the whole concept of science will have to change once we accept mind and the subtle things and thoughts and everything like that. So of course some scientists are also going in that direction now, and they're saying that evolution may be there or whatever, but it's not chance. It's the thought can influence the matter to change, and therefore you evolve according to your needs, and your needs are determined by your consciousness. So in other words, the mind, if the insect feels, it's dangerous now and this is very bad, whatever conditions, then based on his reactions and everything, then his genetics mutate in such a way to adapt to the new situation. So in other words, the mind influences the matter like that. It's not chance that does it. So anyway, this is some new things coming up in the material world. But all of these elements have been there in the Vedic literature already. But that we cannot separate them from the soul and from the Supreme Lord. In other words, there's a plan there. There's a whole plan there. A plan for the jiva within the material world. A plan for his enjoyment. And a plan to get him out. And that's all under the Lord's control. So those, they're subtle laws, in other words, also. That we have gross laws for matter. And we have laws for the mind. We also have laws for the soul also. And it's all under the Supreme Lord. So when we discover those laws, then we're on the right track of real science. But we're just dealing with these gross material laws, and we'll not come to right conclusions at all. Okay.
Maharaj, thinking with feelings, does that take place on the subtle level?
Thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we were discussing earlier about the controlling mind and controlling that model.
Yeah.
I was thinking, wow, wonderful, you know, it would be great if we could program, you know, get people to program us to think of Krishna all the time.
I hypnotize you, think of Krishna.
it would seem that it's quite evident that we can't do it that way. Because it's actually the choice that we make.
The free will is involved, yeah.
The choice belongs to the soul. The choice belongs.
Yeah, it's not the mind. The mind is only an instrument. It doesn't choose anything. It's the soul that must choose this. So when we hypnotize somebody, basically, we're bypassing the soul and everything, and we're just making them do something, by giving commands and putting it in the mind. Just like a machine, and we're just programming the machine like a computer or something like that, part of the mind, to do these things, and
so
without the consent of the soul. So this is what we call brainwashing. And that's what they accuse us of doing. The difference is we do it voluntarily. We consent to do something. So then, in a sense, yes, we are programming ourselves. When you do anything, you're programming yourself. To study, to pass an exam, you have to program yourself to study. Who wants to study for, 10 hours a day to pass an exam? You program yourself to do that. You make yourself do it, and then you train yourself in certain ways. If you want to be a basketball star, or cricket star, or whatever, or a runner, or anything, you program yourself in a certain way to do it. And you make your body do certain things, and you train your body to do certain things. That's programming, basically, also. But of course, voluntarily, we're doing that. Now, of course, if you do it voluntarily, you can increase the effects, probably, by a little of the other stuff, hypnosis and everything. I think that's what some of the athletes do. They probably do take hypnosis to, relax and then concentrate more and things like that, So they have doctors to do that also in sports medicine, probably do that. So you can aid it in everything. But the other way, of course, is to make it all involuntary in one sense, in which I think they've also done in the military. They train people up using these techniques where they can do superhuman feats under, programming or whatever. And they can develop remarkable, powers that way of endurance and, skill and whatever. That they normally wouldn't have, and they'll do it under trance state or this type of programming state. So they develop that, but it's somebody else that has to make them do it, and they don't even know they're doing it afterwards. So they don't really get any satisfaction out of that either, because somebody else is making them do it, and for some other motive. And sooner or later, the whole thing will crash anyway. After many years, they'll discover that they're being manipulated to do all that stuff, and then they'll just reject the whole thing. So we also, anything we practice voluntarily, then and we put our mind to it, that's a type of programming also. But the difference is it's voluntary. The other one is involuntary, and you're manipulated to, they're tricking your mind to do all these different things. Whereas in the other case, we consent, and then by our free will, we utilize certain methods of getting determination and then accomplishing something using the mind. The mind is just an instrument, and it's a little bit lazy, and to get it to do anything you have to repeat and make it fall into certain patterns, and once it falls into a pattern, then it gets lazy again and it'll stick in the pattern. You don't have to push it too much. So that's basically what we have to do with the mind. That's called conditioning of the mind. So that's normally what we have to do. So we have to practice, sadhana, practicing remembering Krishna. And of course, free will is harder to use the free, to operate with the free will than just to put a command in by hypnosis into you. A command by hypnosis is very quick, but free will, you really want to, whether you're going to choose or not, you know, you hesitate. It may take you years to choose to do it. Huh? But when you make a choice, of course, then it's, you know, pretty permanent. But this hypnosis thing is done on a superficial level. It's very quick, but again, you know, it'll wear off sooner or later.
So it's the soul that's choosing.
It should choose. Should that? Yeah. Well, the soul is obviously connected with our mind, inner intelligence, and everything. So, but ultimately, when we get faith, faith is a symptom of the soul. Actually, faith is spiritual; it's not material. So, when we get faith, which is the beginning of bhakti, that's coming from the soul, not from the mind or the intelligence or whatever. Then, with that faith, then we have our gross mind and intelligence and stuff, and then we hear things and we absorb knowledge, and with that faith then we hear certain things and it makes sense to us. We read Bhagavad Gita. Oh, that's true. It sounds like it's reasonable. So that's where our intelligence is becoming spiritualized, by the faith of the soul. So we'll pick up on the spiritual things, you know, with our intelligence that way. But it's ultimately coming from the soul's faith.
Intelligence
and discriminating power. Yeah. But unfortunately, in the material world, we discriminate the wrong way. In other words, even if we read Bhagavad Gita, a materialist, he'll discriminate. He'll understand the sentences and everything, but still, he can't figure out what is this talk about soul and whatever. You know, that discriminate. He won't go that far to discriminate between matter and soul. Whereas if we have faith coming from the soul, then immediately we'll pick up on that. Yeah.
How does the subliminal types on that level, does that influence the...
That's like hypnosis. It's just working with the mind. Right? But of course, there it's a little better because at least we consent to do it ahead of time and we get ourselves to do it. You know, so it's like aiding one of our goals, which we consciously want. We want, we're trying to get that goal, so therefore it increases our incentive or whatever.
I've read, I've done experiments in shops having subliminal tapes running that don't steal, and they've managed to reduce the shoplifting.
I think it's illegal now, though. I think so. Because that's again against your will that they're using this thing. But techniques like that, which isn't exactly those messages, but they probably also use on television in advertisements, things like that. Not only verbal, oral things that you can't hear, but they're there, messages, plus visuals also, which will affect you, which you don't see. And they flash them on the screen and television, but it's so fast your eye doesn't pick up on it, you know? But in advertisements they'll do that, and then this way they influence your mind also. So there are all sorts of techniques in the water world to control you. The mind is a very strange thing, and it picks up the weirdest things, and we're not even aware of it, but it can influence us. And they picked up on these things, and through experiments, and then they use them against your will to influence you for buying things, getting money out of you by putting them in advertisements and stuff like that. So they use these techniques to. That's why when you watch television, you can't stop. Basically, you just get attracted to it for some reason. So they got some messages in there that make you sit there and absorb all their stuff, and then go out and buy all the stuff. It's a very clever way of making money.
So, Maharaj, that means when, as practicing devotees, when we experience something on the bodily platform and even on the subtle platform, we really have to know that that has, even though it seems so real, that's us, we have to know actually where the spiritual being within that gross and subtle body, and therefore, with high intelligence, keep on doing devotional service instead of just gratifying those two levels?
The higher realization, of course, is the soul is the most important thing there, and the true orientation of the soul towards Krishna, that's the best orientation, and everything should follow from that. If it doesn't, if the soul is going in the opposite direction, then obviously we end up covered with ignorance, working in the material world and getting karma, and then suffering for that. And when we turn towards Krishna with faith, then basically that ignorance is destroyed. And the karma is destroyed. All these things are destroyed. Then we can be peaceful, even if we have a material body.
We are talking about some elements, and in the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada talks about the lowest is Anu, the atom, but then the scientists, they say they can break the atoms.
Particles. Well, the particle, the atom theory, actually, I think, is one of these other, which is Kannada. Kannada's theory of atoms, I think, Vaisheshika philosophy or something. He has the theory of particles, indivisible particles. In Bhagavatam, it talks about these particles, also the smallest particle. But it doesn't, which particle it is, whether it's the atom or the proton or the neutron, it doesn't actually specify which one it is. I think in modern physics, as far as particles are concerned, they talk about particles, but they know that they're not actually particles. They're charges, basically charges of some sort, without dimension.
But they claim to be subatomic particles.
Yeah, I think they use that term, but I think they don't mean them as solid things. They're actually charges. But then what is a charge ultimately? Even that's very difficult for us to define eventually. It's some sort of energy. That's about as far as we can say. Some sort of energy particle.
I read somewhere that they're concluding that more resembles a sound vibration.
Yeah, we can say take it that way also. It's a vibration, basically. Everything is a vibration. And that fits in very well because we know that the ultimate, the finest gross element is ether, which is we call space or something like that. Yeah? But actually it's not just space, it's matter. Ether is matter in Vedic science. And it's the medium of sound, of vibration. And it's from that that all the other elements expand, through vibration. So we get sound operating through ether. And then that creates the next element down, the air element. And then the air element creates the fire element. The fire element creates the water, and the water creates the earth. Like this, and goes downwards. So the first one is the ether. And the ether is, above the ether is the mind. And the mind seems to operate through the ether also. In other words, it generates, thought is generated in vibrations also. And that creates sound, and then goes down like that. So then the thought and the ether and everything are kind of very much related to each other in terms of vibrations or something like this, Very subtle, of course. And then you get grosser and grosser. So we can say maybe that all matter is basically thought. Ultimately, thought vibrations getting on lower and lower levels. And how is it all ultimately coming out of false ego? It's all false. It all has a false foundation. Simply to enjoy separately from Krishna. Okay. Hare Krishna.